Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio today by a very special guest, Gerhard Lau from Deutsche Telekom. Hello, Gerhard.
Welcome. Hi, good morning, Rachel. Thank you.
No problem. Good to have you here. And Gerhard, you're head of international media management, right?
At Deutsche Telekom, yeah.
Yes, excellent. And joining us, we also have Lindsay Rountree, head of content for ExchangeWire.
Hello.
Hi, Lindsay. And I should introduce myself. I'm Rachel Smith, COO of ExchangeWire.
Yes, you should introduce yourself.
I should, but I feel like, you know, this is third week running now. Everyone on the Mad Tech Podcast knows this voice.
And they should.
It is distinctive.
Yes, that's it. That's it. Good to have another Antipodean on the mic today.
Yeah. Ex-South African, now German.
Okay.
But I have hearts. I have two hearts and they're both beat separately, but together.
Excellent. You've got yourself covered on all bases there.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's dive into the first news story of the week. Widely covered, big news story, frankly, that sort of broke towards the end of last week, over the weekend, has been talked about excessively already at the start of this week, which is US Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren's intention to break up big tech companies. So were she be elected to the White House, she's been outlining some specific proposals on how to tackle companies who've got too much power over, she sort of coins the phraseology, US society, the US economy and their sense of democracy. She goes on to say that she feels like regulators have been too slack in the sort of digital industries with regards to various mergers and acquisitions over the years, and that, you know, she makes very clearly the point, particularly to people that try to sort of pigeonhole her as a socialist, that she's very much coming at this from capitalist principles, but that she feels that these tech companies haven't contributed their fair share and that they've been allowed to grow and dominate in a way that's undermined some of the principles of capitalism, which is, you know, entrepreneurialism and fairness and the opportunity to sort of succeed economically. And, you know, she's quite kind of keen on the rhetoric around creating a more competitive and level playing field. So what's really interesting about this is that obviously it has enormous impact on the world of advertising technology because the big tech companies she's talking about really are Google, Facebook, Amazon and the like. Were she to be successful, you know, with her proposals, if she manages to make it to the White House, she'd be talking about attaining these companies a different status or a particular status, calling them platforms and enshrining in law that a platform company can't own and operate the platform. And that would in effect have the outcome of separating Facebook from WhatsApp and Instagram, Google from their ad management platform, Amazon from their sort of owned product line marketplace. Mm-hmm. So fascinating. Really interested in both of your perspectives on this, the impact that it's got on the world of advertising and marketing technology. And I suppose it's also a bit related to some of the things we were talking about in last week's podcast too, which is it's creating this landscape and environment of government regulation and control around big technology. So, yeah, I'm going to throw over to you first, Gerhard. What's your view on these developments?
Well, I think the first thing to say is, you know, most industries are regulated. So this idea of, oh, this lady wants to regulate the tech industry, people get very upset about it. Let's face it, most industries, if not all industries, are regulated. If you look at the pharmaceutical industry, extremely heavily regulated. The telecommunication industry, the industry we operate in, is also very regulated. If I just give an example of roaming fees within Europe, I think we all know the story about how the EU government decided that, okay, roaming fees is not a good thing. We don't want our consumers to pay just because they're in a different country and on a different network. So over time, you know, roaming fees are a thing of the past. So I'm not saying regulation is always the best thing to manage companies. And there's the whole, you know, government versus economy discussion. But the first thing to say is regulation is not the worst thing in the world. And it could also be good. It could be good for consumers, certainly. It could be good for advertisers. I think we shouldn't necessarily say bad thing, we don't want it.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you hit on that point of regulation, because I think I was also reading some stuff, just sort of some general commentary, people sharing the article on LinkedIn, and someone saying, well, is she going to apply the same forceful nature around regulation of other company mergers? And I think the example that they were, well, this is it.
Yeah.
I think the example they gave was of some telco operational mergers that are in the wings in the US.
Absolutely.
But I was thinking to myself, well, those industries are already very heavily regulated. Those mergers always have to go before a kind of competition commission.
For sure. Yeah.
So how is this any different?
Yeah.
Lindsay, what's your take on this?
It reminds me of an anecdote in the American sitcom 30 Rock, where they're talking about vertical integration, which is exactly what this all of this is.
Yeah.
And they give an example of a snack company that is going to buy a company that sells anti-diarrhea medication. I'm sorry to be crass, but that is what the anecdote is.
First thing in the morning as well.
I know, I do apologise. But the example they give is that, that's fantastic, because actually when I buy a pack of these snacks, I could then be given a sample of the anti-diarrhea medication that's put in. And then the penny drops. It's like, oh my God, what if they actually then put something in the snack to make them give diarrhea, that I have to keep buying the anti-diarrhea medication? And that is just basically what Google and Facebook and Amazon have kept on doing. And they've been buying things rather than building them. And the things they've bought, they've been able to kind of just use what they've already got to kind of make them better and better and better and shove off the competition. The competition that arguably generally has no choice but to use Google or Facebook or Amazon. Amazon Basics being a great example that Warren does use in her, she actually names Amazon Basics as an example. I want to break them off, because the reason they exist is because they are actually taking a lot of the customers that have made Amazon what they are and have copied them and made them cheaper and actually have put some of these people out of business. And, you know, they're now trying to sue Amazon. No chance, unfortunately. And that's a big, big problem. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the power that the likes of Google and Facebook have, and you should be kind of, Google should be divesting DoubleClick, because it is not right that they have that control over the market. So it does make a lot of place. And Gerhard, exactly everything you said. We're the only industry that isn't regulated. We need to have something. And we talked about this on the podcast last week with Ruth Zora about the fact that from a European perspective, these companies can't just be bowling around the European markets with no regulation. Unfortunately, our markets don't have the capacity to be able to regulate them properly. And it's meant that they could actually largely go and do what they like for the past few years. And actually, as largely they're US companies, maybe that's the starting point. They need to be regulated by the US first before we can actually have any say over what they are able to do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the thing is, we shouldn't underestimate the power of these companies. I think you guys in the industry know how strong they are. And I think once that is established, we all know they're very big and powerful, and they make a lot of money. I think it's important to also look at what roles do they play in the industry. And I think this is exactly what you're saying, Lindsay. They are many, many things to many people. And especially if we look at it from a consumer perspective and an advertiser perspective, there are many things. And I think that's more or less where the problem comes in, that they could be an extremely strong media owner, probably the strongest media owner in the world, that I don't think anyone would really have a very big problem with that. If they're good and, you know, fantastic, let's buy media space from them. You know, that's one thing, but they're not just one thing. They're also, as you mentioned, a tech provider. So, you know, then exactly that blurring of lines starting to happen. They're not only a tech provider, but they also, you know, are a competitor to many of us, and including in the telecom space. So then it's sort of, you know, what are they really? And I think that's the problem, that they're many things to many people at the same time. And I think what she's saying, that's how I interpret it, saying, okay, maybe you're just too many things. You're just spanning too many categories, too many industries. And let's try and break it up a little bit. So it's saying, okay, what is it? Are you a media owner? Are you a technology provider? Or are you a telecommunications company?
Yeah. I think that's really interesting. I thought the other thing that's quite interesting about this is, you know, this is a proposal that she's putting forward, and of course there'll be some debate around her sort of the drivers for her putting this particular point of view forward. But it occurred to me that this might become a bit of a cross-party thing, actually, because you can't say that even the existing US government led by Trump has been shy of wanting to get in the way of big commercial mergers. You know,
he wasn't keen on the
AT&T and Time Warner merger. You know, it's almost, I can see it as one of those issues issues that, you know, whether it's capitalism versus socialism or responsible capitalism or what have you, that might come down to the heart of, but actually this is ruining the economy and the society and, you know, American society, because it's, you know, creating, it's not creating a competitive enough environment for companies to survive and thrive and grow. It means that those companies, big and enormous as they are sort of creating little subcultures within the cities or the states that they have their offices or don't have their offices, you know, hugely controversial around where Amazon was choosing to set up their new office. There's always lots of controversy around big tech companies settling in San Fran and pushing housing prices up and cost of living and all of that sort of stuff. So they seem to have, like you say, Gerhard, so many functions. Yeah. Maybe it's an opportunity from a sort of, you know, government perspective to sit back and say, well, let's define what these companies are actually doing and make sure that they're operating in a fair and legal way within those particular mm-hmm. industries or verticals.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that this is also, you know, I think I said this last week as well. Do you think it's kind of sounding the bell, which is, you know, okay, who knows how far this will go? This is obviously just a proposal that's put forward by a potential presidential candidate. But do you think this is sounding the bell to those big tech companies? Regulation, control is coming. You can't, you know, because we're having the same conversations in Europe as well.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think it is, because actually everything that Warren's put forward makes sense. And a lot of people will look at that and they can't really disagree with it. Even people in this industry that are kind of very, very embedded in this industry will look at that and go, yeah, you know what? That actually is not a bad idea. Like everything that she suggested, breaking off DoubleClick from Google, breaking off Amazon Basics from Amazon, breaking off Instagram and WhatsApp and, you know, from Facebook and even Waze from Google, they are all things that everyone would go, yeah, they are a step too far in terms of the power these companies have over the multiple industries they operate in. Yeah. So everybody else could look at that and they wouldn't just go, oh, it's just because it's a thing from her party, it's irrelevant. They look at it and go, actually, that makes a lot of sense. We should be looking at this as a serious way of breaking up these big companies. And that would then spark probably other conversations happening in other markets as well. Like, you know, we're already having these conversations in Europe, but it would then give them, I guess, reason to be able to go, that is how, if we want to break them up, that's how we do it. Because actually, they're really quite decent suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think the momentum in Europe is also building. I think, you know, there's been so much happening in the whole legal space with regards to GDPR and managing of data, user data, opt-in, opt-out, all those discussions that we've been having over the last 2-3 years. And I think that also shows in the court cases that have come out against Google, for example, from France yes. A few weeks ago. So I think there's certainly a movement and a feeling amongst many advertisers and industry players that, you know, we need to do something, that the power of the walled gardens, as we call them, you know, are of such an extent that it is not necessarily to the benefit of our businesses or of to consumers.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Mm. Okay. Helpful segue this discussion into news story number two, which was Mark Zuckerberg's blog post that, again, was also widely covered in the press late last week, where he was outlining the ethos behind the announcement that they made a few weeks ago of their desire to merge WhatsApp, Instagram and Messenger. And so in his blog post, he really sort of detailed that this for Facebook was a step towards creating private environments for Facebook users to interact. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say that he, you know, fairly clearly emphasized Facebook's desire to protect user data and privacy, and to do that in a way that, you know, he feels is meaningful to people that are wanting to use those messaging apps. Now, obviously this would be a big move, you know, merging WhatsApp, Instagram and Facebook. Interested in your views on this, because we know that Facebook numbers are plateauing and decreasing in some markets across Europe and the US. So is this an attempt to sort of bring users back into the fold and to attempt to grow user numbers as it were, and to try to instill confidence again in Facebook users? Or, you know, more a sort of from a more sinister perspective, is it Mark Zuckerberg's attempt to gain as much control as possible over the assets that are WhatsApp, Instagram and Messenger before some regulation comes down the line and says, actually, you've got to break this apart. This is not, you know, this is anti-competitive. And I guess the third point is it also perhaps a response to the sort of business that WeChat and China have set up, that we know some other sort of kind of quite innovative brands in Asia are also setting up, where they're effectively creating utility apps. You might use them for one thing, WeChat for messaging, but you can also pay your utility bills, you know, renew your passport, a little bit like Grab in Malaysia and Singapore, where it was a ride-hailing, ride-sharing service to start with, but it's also offering other utilities as well, financial products, as well as other sort of personal administration utility offerings. And is that what he's attempting to do here, is my question. Lindsay, let's go to you first.
There's so much to unpick from it. And actually kind of reading an article at The Guardian, have kind of got, done a deep dive into what each of the points mean. And I feel like, first and foremost, the blog post is an attempt to speak to Facebook's users rather than people that understand the problems that Facebook are currently in. And the way he talked about privacy and user data, he's talking about it from a, we will make sure that people that you don't know can't see what you're posting, as in you other users of Facebook. He isn't talking about it from how your data will be used. And I think that's probably quite a key point, that he's not actually specified that your data will be protected. He's talked a lot about encryption, but the example here that's given is that the encryption we're talking about is end-to-end encryption. So nobody, including Facebook, can actually see what's being messaged, but they can still see who's messaging who. And they can still gain user data, the metadata they're calling it, the user data, to understand who is doing what, where, why, how, and build an inference to then still use it for audience targeting. And that, I think, is one of the big problems that Facebook come under fire for. So they still haven't really addressed it. And what you say, Rachel, about the kind of the China or the Southeast Asia companies like Grab and WeChat and Line as well, that have created these kind of mass companies, ties in really nicely with what Elizabeth Warren's saying, which is I want those companies not to exist. And actually, we've talked in the past, and Facebook should be looking to go into the e-commerce route, and will they buy a payment platform like Stripe, for example? Actually, if Warren has her way and if other people get on the same bandwagon, that's never going to happen. And the beauty of the Asian market is the consumers understand the value exchange. They know their data is being used and abused by every company that they deal with, and every company that operates within the WeChat ecosystem or the Line ecosystem or the Grab ecosystem, their data is being used probably nefariously, but they don't mind because they're getting a great service out of it. We don't operate that way in the West. I think that's a problem at the moment, and the fact that we are trying to bring regulation in just proves even more that we don't want to operate that way in the West. So actually, Facebook trying to get even more involved in other aspects and other verticals of our lives, I think they'll come under fire for.
And it'll be reviewed suspiciously. It's just not surprising at all,
yeah,
really.
Totally.
Yeah,
totally. Because they haven't really kind of covered themselves in glory. They haven't confirmed that, okay, fine, we've listened, we're going to fix this. They've not really said that.
No, not at all. Yeah. Gerhard, what's your perspective?
I think they're probably looking at it from a business maturity perspective, right? So if you look at Facebook as a product, it is a pretty mature business, whereas the other two, certainly WhatsApp and Instagram, are still growing rapidly. And I mean, maybe Instagram is growing at the expense of Facebook, but I mean, there's a lot of movement in those products, but they're certainly increasing their users, whereas Facebook isn't necessarily doing that, certainly in the Western world. So if I would just put my sort of thinking cap on how they would think about it, they probably would think, well, we have mature businesses and we have growing businesses. And how can we bring them together and how can we make the most of it? And I think it's probably not much more than that. Of course, there are other bigger picture things behind there, as you say, more services, certainly. Maybe the data pieces is another reason why they're thinking of that. But I would say that probably the main motivation is at this stage is just saying, okay, well, some businesses are doing really well, some aren't. How can we bring them together? Also, maybe to make the user experience a little bit more seamless, right? So now we all have three apps, right? So they're very different and very separate from each other, and we use them for different things. You know, I want to see what my mother's doing, I would go on Facebook. I want to see what my friends are doing, I'll do it on Instagram, and I want to chat to my partner, I'll do it on on WhatsApp. So, you know, they're sort of quite separate universes.
Yeah.
And I would imagine from a business perspective, they must think, well, let's bring them together. Maybe the WeChat is a very good example of saying, how can we make it more seamless and one, and not have this sort of high spike, huge amount of users that come and then they go again.
Yeah.
Because, you know, yeah, they're now going to Instagram, but where will they go afterwards? So I'm sure their thinking is, let's keep them there. Let's make sure that everyone can find what they're looking for in one sort of unified platform.
And what about, I'm wondering about the impact for advertisers then as well, because we would be talking potentially about, we know that Facebook's really popular with advertisers because it's a great place to find the audiences that you're looking for at scale. So, you know, what would bringing these three platforms together do to that experience? Mm. Are we talking about less user numbers? It's a more private environment. Mm-hmm. So what would the advertising opportunities be like? What would the user experience be like? What's your perspective on that from an advertiser point of view?
I think there are definitely a few things to think of. Firstly, the numbers are great. Of course, you know, advertisers, especially of mass brands like ours, are always looking for reach, right? So the numbers are good. So there are a lot of people on the platform, and that's always a good thing. Then I think the other thing to think about is the user experience, as you mentioned. So how do people in that environment perceive advertising? And I think that's also a very interesting and important thing to ask. And I think if we look at Facebook, where the role, or let's say the perception of advertising has changed over time to the negative, I must unfortunately confirm. So if you speak to advertisers today and they say, well, does Facebook build your brand? Are people engaging with your content, with your video? I would think the answer is mostly yes, but it has decreased tremendously if we look at how long videos are watched for example. So, you know, I think that one has to think of the user experience in Facebook, which is more of a scrolling kind of user experience. Advertising doesn't have that much impact. And then I think on Instagram, we sort of early phases, and WhatsApp has hardly started, you know, facilitating advertising. So I'm sure they must also look at that from a maturity perspective and going like, well, your Facebook used to be or is still a big platform for advertisers.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not necessarily growing. And I think the reason is quite clear is because of the usage of the platform doesn't really allow for advertising to have a big impact or have a lot of, you know, face time with the ads. So they must also look at that and say, well, maybe the other platforms have more opportunities for users to engage with advertising content.
And this is an interesting point though, right? Because if advertisers feel like they can't find the audience on Facebook, then...
Well, they can find the audience, but can they find the engagement? Yes. Can they find the attention for their messages? I think that this is a big problem.
And if those metrics start to change, then...
Exactly.
That means a big shift, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's not that much to shift to, but I think that...
Well, you wonder, don't you? Does this sort of open the door for the next thing? I don't know what the next thing is. I don't know, you know. But we know that one of the reasons that advertisers flock to Facebook is because of the reach.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if anything happens to sort of slow that down, then obviously people will be looking around for alternatives.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, Instagram and WhatsApp will be very good alternatives if there's opportunities for advertisers to be in there, and if users accept it, if they accept advertising on their platform, especially WhatsApp, which is a very personal platform. Yeah, there are brands engaging and there are some engagement with companies on a service level, etc. But it's not really established as a advertising platform. So I'm sure that's also probably part of the thinking in terms of this maturity, that brands on Facebook are quite mature. It's not necessarily growing. So where would they go and where can they go? And how can Facebook as a company capitalize on that possible movement?
And for our conspiracy theorist listeners,
will you get this?
Gerhard, this is Exchange Wire. Yes, there are. Yeah, yeah. Will he get this through before any regulation comes down the line? As in, you know, will they manage to merge these products? Will he make a success of that before anyone gets in the way?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think so too.
Yeah. I do too.
He knows exactly what he's doing.
Yeah.
And people make these things public, so it just spurs him along to have to move quicker.
Yeah.
Like, he knows that his cars are marked. He knows that there's limited time to do this.
Exactly. Yeah, so making these announcements is a way of sort of, you know, showing his hand, really, which is this is what we're going to do, and we're going to do it as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And normally businesses are a little bit faster than government, generally speaking. So.
Just a little bit.
A little bit.
Shock, I suppose.
Yes. let's not get into politics. It's all sort of nervous, hot under the collar around Europe at the moment.
Yeah, so, for sure.
So moving on to the third news story this week which is focusing on the WFA releasing their report on global media agency models and remuneration models, which was released a few days ago. So this was a really interesting report, which was getting members and others feedback on agency models and remuneration models. There was a number of recommendations, there's a number of findings that came out of the report, and there was a couple that I wanted to focus on in particular because they're firmly focused on the topic of in-housing, which we like to talk about quite a lot here at ExchangeWise. So I was quite interested in two of the points that came out. One is that the appetite for change is concentrated around in-housing or hybrid models, meaning amongst brands, within brands. So 68% of people that responded to the survey are more likely to move to some version of in-housing or hybrid models over the next 3 to 5 years. And that's in favour of, not in-housing at all or taking it 100% in-house. And then there was also a follow-up sort of finding from that, which was that despite the confidence that a lot of brands have got in housing, around in housing, the sort of value of it, that it still remains to be a bit of a divisive issue, and that there are a number of brands that felt that, it's considered a bit of a false economy, because, even really established in housing operations still depend quite a lot on agency support. So I just thought the report was really interesting. The findings were quite interesting. And these two particular points I thought were an interesting thing for us to discuss and debate a little bit, because this is a message that we're hearing time and again, that there is sort of undeniable value in the notion of in-housing because brands want a lot more transparency, because there's just been so much, what was it that Danny Spears said a couple of weeks ago? There's opacity by design baked into the sort of advertising, the buying and selling of advertising, and the sort of optimizing of marketing. So we know that that's a response to that, but what is it actually like on the ground for brands, and how are they actually making this happen? What does it look like in reality? And this seems to really sort of highlight those points. So I'm going to obviously go to you first, Gerhard, because you've no doubt got a lot to say on this.
I do. Deutsche Telekom is a proud member of the WFA. Myself, I'm very involved and very active in the WFA, especially in the Media Forum, and also serving on the Global Media Council, and a number of my colleagues also involved in different aspects of the discussion. So I think this report is very interesting, and I saw it when it came out, and I was also one of the participants. And I think it is a very good, snapshot of where we are as an industry now. And this certainly reflects where big advertisers are going. I think one always has to distinguish between what are the big brands doing, companies that spend hundreds of millions on advertising in a year, and smaller, medium-sized companies and smaller companies. I think they're very different worlds out there. So one shouldn't say, well, this is where our industry as a whole is going. But I think this reflects where big clients are going, or big advertisers. Yeah. And I think the point clearly is that the model is changing. And, if we look at what is the old model and where is it going? I mean, and what is the new model? The old model is literally an advertiser doing everything with an agency. So basically, an advertiser really using an agency for almost all the services, and not necessarily one agency. It might be a creative agency, media agency, branding agency, event, etc. So there were always, I think, a portfolio of agencies. But if we now look at media and the paid media space, for a long time it has been the one agency model, right?
Yeah.
So my agency does everything, with its strategy, with its planning, with its buying, with its measurement. So I think what is changing is that model is changing. So the hybrid model that is mentioned in the report is certainly very closely also reflecting what we are doing at Deutsche Telekom. So we decided already in 2017 that we're going to change the entire model, and we want to work differently with our agencies. So we introduced a new model. It's called the Media Operating Model, or MOM for short, and it is exactly that, a hybrid model. So it means the way that we look at it is we differentiate, or we split up the scope that one media agency would have, or the main media agency would have, into different components. So we're saying we're moving away from this one agency does everything to various specialists, various agencies doing different components of the scope of work. And on top of that, of course, it also means that we as an advertiser need to be more involved. So it is also about control. And I remember when we started talking about this, our new model, and control about more than 2 years ago, people were quite scared of the word control because, you know, it does have negative connotations. People are like, what, control? You want to control who? Or, you know, what's the story with control? But I think advertisers are using that word more and more, saying we want to have more control of where our media is going and our money is going, how media is bought, how it's planned, what the strategy is behind it, and what happens. So let's say the results or the outcomes. So I think that is the one of the overall movements behind it. Of course, the other things we talked about, transparency, data safety and security, more access, more involvement. I think those are other motivations behind it. So I completely get the story about more hybrid models.
Yep.
Now, on the in-house models, I'm not so sure. I must be honest, I think amongst large advertisers, there is a very small group of advertisers who can and will be successful in the in-house model over time. I think there's a very, very, very small group of them. I mean, the pure online players, of course, I'm not even talking about them.
Yep.
You know, the Booking.coms or the Zalando's and the, you know, these kind of companies who have their business as an, let's say, a digital business, an online business. For them, it makes sense. And if you look at the way they set up, if you look at the way they work, they do that.
Very technology focused, very tech and digital first.
And very in-house focused. So a lot of the work, whether it's programmatic, whether it's search, whether it's analytics, are done by people in-house. They use agencies. They still use agencies mainly for TV buying, print, out-of-home buying. So their model is a flipped model of how most advertisers work. So I think let's just exclude that group for a moment and say, well, they're going to keep on doing what they're doing, and you know, they always have a main in-house model with using some agency services. But if we look at, let's say, traditional, more old world advertisers, if I can use that word, like ourselves, the car companies, the FMCGs, the banks, these kind of legacy companies, if I can call it that, I think in-housing will be a model for very few of them.
Yeah. And that's because?
I think the main reason is that it is so far from our core business. You know, if I look at us as a telecommunication company, our core business has very little to do with advertising and nothing to do with media buying. Our core business is about networks, it's about infrastructure, it's about connecting people and providing them with connectivity and services on top of that. So media buying, programmatic buying, you know, people hands on keyboards, people actually putting campaigns into lines. Lindsay, you worked in an agency, you know exactly what I'm talking about, putting them into the systems, you know, working on the ad server, working on the DSP, working on the segmentation. It's very, very far from
your area
business.
Of expertise.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a conversation we had on stage at HS London last year, which was, you know, EA Games. They are tech people. They have built games. It makes sense for them to build their own bidder, to build their own advertising technology. But on the flip side of it, another example was given about a company that sells dairy products trying to build a DMP.
Exactly.
You're not equipped to build a DMP, so you shouldn't be trying to build a DMP. You should be focused on selling dairy products. And that's exactly what you're talking about, the legacy versus the digital native brands, if you like. It makes sense because they're already in that area and they can they can really excel at it.
Yeah. And they have the people and the expertise and the processes.
Yeah.
And it's in their DNA, absolutely.
Exactly. And interesting what you're talking about, the mom model that you have.
Yeah,
and as long as there have been agencies, there's obviously been a kind of an ebb and flow in how brands work with agencies, and either focusing to have everything in one with one agency, or then going, no, we want to split it up and we want to use specialist agencies. And, you know, as you mentioned, I used to work in an agency. I've experienced that myself. Has Deutsche Telekom gone through that similar kind of similar experience? And have you decided, there's always questions around, well, if we use multiple agencies, they won't work together.
Yeah.
They are competitive with each other.
Yeah.
They won't talk to each other completely. And then we'll have to be the ones picking up the pieces versus putting it all in one. Yeah. You're giving all your control to one agency and then you're losing it. Kind of, where's this happy medium?
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's a very, very good question. And that's, of course, what advertisers need to answer for themselves. No one can tell them how to do that. There's definitely not one model out there. That fallacy we should just, you know, dispel right here and then. There's not one model for large advertisers. And each advertiser needs to find their own model. You know, what will work for us? And that's why, you know, why I was talking about the core business. You have to really ask yourself, what are we good at? What can we do? What is the appetite within the organization? How deep does my organization want to be involved in the media business? You know, do we really want to have... Our way of solving that is by having experts in-house, real analytic experts, for example, programmatic digital experts in-house that work with the partners, so they work with the agencies. So it's not the hands-on keyboard model, but it's having people in-house that understand, most of them come from agencies, as you can imagine, but they understand both sides of the coin, and they can help us to understand also what is good work and what makes sense and what isn't, you know, that transparency control story. So I think the model is, there's not one model. You really, each advertiser have to say, well, what do we want to do? What are our objectives? How do we want to set up? How are we set up? How do we want to work with agencies?
And how do you get to that place then? That sounds like a big piece of work, right?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. That's been a fantastic journey, I must say. It's been more than 2 years on this journey. And I think I'll just sort of maybe mention the main stages. So the first stage we did was we did quite a big internal project. So we brought a whole lot of experts from across the business together at one table. So you can imagine a lot of colleagues from the brand media department, the traditional paid media expert who spent most of the budget in the traditional media. But then, of course, the guys from e-business, you know, who really understand the digital channels and especially digital channels in the sales environment. Then, of course, procurement experts. Also data and technology experts. So we had a huge big table of different experts within the organization representing different areas of the paid media puzzle. And we then decided that we are going to really spend some time defining a new model. So before we actually started doing pitches, or, you know, that's always the sort of thing, oh, let's do a new pitch, let's change the scope of work, or let's redefine the scope of work. We said, we're not going to do that now. That was phase two, but let's in phase one define a new model. So we got an external consultant in, and they help us just to do an analysis. Where are our businesses? How are they working? And of course, working across many countries, 13 in Europe and the US, not all countries, not all markets are the same.
Using the same approach. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. So they're more digitally, more very advanced markets. They're markets where TV is still the main medium and will remain for the foreseeable future. So they're very, they're big markets with large budgets, some with small, some with very strong focus on e-commerce, using digital channels for e-commerce, some that are selling less online and more in stores. So, you know, those kind of nuances between the markets or the countries or the NatCos, as we call them, are very important. So all of that was taken into consideration. We also looked at technology and where that's going, data, the whole data piece. And then we came up with this model. And it's very interesting that you said that, Lindsay, because of course the collaboration, we call it collaboration piece, was one of the main concerns from the beginning. We said, okay, we're breaking the scope up. We're having large and small suppliers or agencies or companies working next to each other. Some are very specialized, some are more general. How are they going to work together? This collaboration piece, because that could really be the downfall of a complex model like this, right? People don't know how to work together, or they just don't want to. So we came up with the idea of collaboration by design. So collaboration was part of the model all along. And throughout the process that then followed the definition of the model, which the phase two was then, of course, doing the pitches for the different pieces of work or the different scopes of work. Collaboration was always part of that. We had a very big collaboration workshop in the RFP stage, request for proposal stage, bringing all the partners together, competitive companies in one room for 2 days having to work together. So it was very clear from our design from the beginning, collaboration is not something that would be nice or would be wish.
Easy.
That's another point. It is by design, and it's also reflected in the remuneration of the agencies, the collaboration, performance.
Interesting. That's a good way of doing it, kind of forcing them to... You won't get paid properly if you don't collaborate with each other.
Exactly.
Play nicely, exactly. Or no one's getting anything.
There's a carrot and stick for you.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's the only way it's going to work, because just asking people to collaborate is not going to work. So there needs to be some incentive, definitely. Mm. Yeah.
Definitely. I feel like we've sort of, already gone into, part two of the podcast, which is focused on Deutsche Telekom, but it's great. It's a fascinating conversation. No. And that last news item was sort of the perfect segue. So just on remuneration then, because I think there was a further point in the WFA report as well about the types of models that people are putting in place for remuneration.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some are payment by results or payment by outcomes.
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. What can you tell us about that?
It's I think it's a very interesting part, and you with your agency experience would know that this is a very big contentious issue within agencies. How are they paid? And we have the traditional, we have the legacy model, which is commission, right? Percentage of our media spend. And I think certainly our model, that was part of the design principles as well as collaboration by design, which I mentioned, one of the principles of the model was payment on an FTE model, on a full-time equivalent basis, paying specific people for the work. Mm. And I think that was, it was quite hard. It was quite hard internally as well to sell that, because it's just so much easier to say, X percentage of my media spend on TV, X percentage on my digital spend will go to the agency's commission. So of the agency's fee, that's a very easy part. So we changed that model quite drastically, which means you need to be much more involved. So it comes back to this sort of control and transparency thing. You know who is working on your business, and you can control that over time. You can even check the hours if you really, really want to. But I think what that does, it does a lot of things for an advertiser. It takes away the incentive of the agency to spend more, right? So the agency was always, I'm not saying all agencies, but I'm sure many agencies were always trying to get more budget, or they were trying to put more budget in areas that are more profitable to them. I mean, this is logic, right? This is normal business sense. So if you take that sort of, we need to spend more in digital, not because it's the best for our campaign or for our consumers, but because the agency makes more money in digital, you take that away by saying, we're paying a digital expert or so many TV experts. So I think that's quite a fundamental change. It's not that easy, because you need to be more involved, certainly, and in the team, and who works on your account, and is one FTE enough, or do you need five or half a person? So I think there's a lot more involvement, but I think that was the first part of the model. And then the other part is what you're talking about, paying by performance. And I think this is certainly, I would say, most large advertisers have a component of their remuneration now based on performance. Mm. And the performance could be many things. I mentioned collaboration already. So a quarter of our performance payment is collaboration. Another quarter is service. Another quarter is business performance. And I'm not talking about the agency's performance. I'm talking about the company's performance. Mm. So, if the company does well on a revenue level, for example, the agency also gets that part of the remuneration. And then the fourth part is, I would call, what we call lot specific KPIs. So really KPIs that the agency can influence, with its input cost, for example, for the main buying agency, with its analytic accuracy for the analytics partner, so model prediction accuracy. So I think there are four components to the model, the way that we see it in terms of managing the performance. But the basic overall model should, in our opinion, should be more of an FTE model.
And there's a lot to be said for the FTE model, but also that your remuneration model as well in general, kind of the way that you're paying out based on business success, so the agency is able to celebrate with you when you're doing well.
Exactly.
Also, the collaboration between different agencies makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But also, it's the big challenge that a lot of agencies will say, particularly within the RFP process and the pitch process, is procurement. And every agency person dreads a procurement person in the room, because... Yeah. Those kinds of sensible conversations around you'll get paid based on what you're doing, and we want you to do FTE, so it's not about you trying to put money in the most profitable places, because that's not good for anybody except your pocket, but in the short term anyway. How you mentioned procurement earlier, and the fact that you had to get all these different teams together to discuss how you would work together to build this new process. How do you remove those silos, and how do you get procurement to understand your greater vision and Deutsche Telekom's greater vision, really?
It's interesting that you mentioned, because it is a very big challenge. But I think there has been huge movements. We talked about the WFA earlier. They also have a sourcing forum, and these are really for procurement people who work in the marketing area. So I think procurement has also moved on, Lindsay, if you ask me. I think there are a lot more people within procurement that understand marketing and that understand media a lot more than they did before. And, you know, we've all heard the horror stories of really bad pitches where, you know, procurement does certain, let's call it e-auctions or certain online actions which really drive prices in a direction which we don't want. And I think that's also the job of people like myself in big organization to work with procurement very closely to make sure they're informed and educated. We're quite lucky in the sense at Deutsche Telekom that we have quite a few colleagues in procurement who comes from the media side, who literally moved from a media role into a procurement role. So they really understand the business. But I mean, to answer your question, how do you get people to work together? I don't think there's really magic. There's not a magic formula. The magic is in bringing the people together and, you know, building a team and just keeping the objectives clear, working together over many months. And you know what it's like working through pitches. It's hugely stressful on the supplier side, on the agency side, but hugely for the client as well. And in our process, we were running up to 4 pitches parallel. So you can imagine.
Wow.
The amount of work and the amount
of stress. That's a lot of work and a lot of pressure.
But for that, you really need a good team and you need people to work together. So that collaboration internally, I think, is the first step.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you often see that advertisers are unhappy with the way they work, whether it's with their creative agency or media agency, and then they change the agency and think the problems are going to go away. But very often the problem is internally. Mm. How do they work together? Their briefing process. It could even be something like the invoicing or the billing process, which is really not at the top of mind of most people when they do a pitch. But it might be that the processes internally aren't streamlined, or the departments aren't aligned on objectives, for example, or the way of working, the outputs, KPI framework, these kind of things. So I think it's very, very important to make sure that you have a very strong internal team. And we do, I'm very happy to say.
And where has that come from in Deutsche Telekom? I mean, presumably at a leadership level.
Yeah.
Are there? Can you identify where within the organization that ethos has come from?
I would say it comes really from a desire to do the best for the company and having great experts around, because I think that's the other thing as well. You know, a lot of companies have a lot of very generalist people or people that are maybe more focused on the creative side of advertising, and I think we're very lucky to have very good deep experts. And I think the vision around this model has really helped to get people together. And it's coming from the head office. So I think that's the other thing to say. You know, the head office, in my opinion, should have a very clear vision and a very, very crisp way of explaining the vision also to the markets, because we are a very decentralized business. So the profit and loss responsibility lies within the market. So it's very easy for them to say, well, head office, great model, nice PowerPoint charts, but excuse me, we're not doing that because we've got to get the business on the road. We have to make the money in the local business, in the local market, and sell products. So thanks for your nice idea. Back on the plane you go.
We're cracking on with the way that we want to do it.
Exactly. So there's a lot of relationship management, of course. There's a lot of convincing. There's a lot of selling involved in implementing this model as well. So, yeah, it's not an easy road.
And have you found – but there must also be – my thinking here is that there must also be some results, right? Yeah, so you
absolutely
must be getting some good results.
Yeah, for sure.
And then secondly, my other thinking just listening to you speak about this is that it strikes me it's a change management tool, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a way to organize a company for the benefit of getting the best results, efficiency gains.
Yeah. And I would say efficiency, yes, but effectiveness. You know, I think this is, for me as a let's say, old-time media person who's been in this industry for a long time. That, I think, is the thing that excites me the most about where we as an industry are going, and also where hopefully Deutsche Telekom is going as well, is this focus on effectiveness. You know, we've really optimized the input side of media. We've optimized the efficiency part. How much do we pay for media? You know, I think through many, many pitches and through many years and great works and audits and all those kind of things, we've really optimized that. But this is not what the business is interested in. If we go back to, you know, what is our core business? It is not media and buying media and the money we pay for media. Our business is not interested in that. Of course, they are. But I mean, what they're really interested in is the results. And that's exactly what you're saying. What are the results of this, let's say, new model, which seems quite complex? You know, can we show results? And I think that that's the piece that's really, for me, very exciting. And we always talk about analytics, media analytics, advanced analytics as, let's say, the only way to measure the outputs, right? So we need advanced modeling, media mix modeling, multi-touch attribution modeling, A-B testing, these kind of things to really show the effectiveness of working in a new way. And it is a process. It's not easy. It's not quick, but that's where we are. And some of our markets are very far advanced already in the media analytics space, advanced analytics space, but we need to get all the markets moving in that direction. Also, this is the area, as I mentioned, where business is interested in. So all of a sudden, the CFOs are interested to say,
yes.
Oh, excuse me, you can predict what our sales will be based on input factors. You're like, yeah, we can. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, we can tell you how much products will sell in a month's time or 2 months' time. That's what interests them.
Yeah.
Not to say, oh, we managed to squeeze, you know,
save
the main TV
money,
part.
Or,
exactly,
yes.
Yeah. Mm. The prices of our media has gone down,
yeah.
cost per GRP or something like that. So this is a very big shift. And models like ours, I think, facilitate that change towards that shift. We're not there yet. We're certainly on a journey. But I think this is where we're going.
And what about the tech side of things? Because
yeah.
you know, you are a telco that
yeah.
has a lot of tech that yeah. relates to that side of the business, mm-hmm. but relates to your core business and mm-hmm. obviously a lot of data as well.
Yeah.
Are you building your own tech? Are you, when you have licensed tech in place, is that the agency licensing or is it direct contracts? How are you managing all of that?
A good question. It's interesting because that's actually something we started with before we started with the new model. So I'm going back to 2014 already. We defined what we call the telecom digital blueprint, which is basically our ad tech stack. It was quite unusual at the time when people were looking at it and going like, what's that?
You know,
what are you trying to do? And to answer your question more directly, Lindsay, no, we're not building our own tech. We are licensing or using tech ourselves, but we are having the contracts directly.
Yeah. Okay.
So we do the pitches,
yep.
whether it's for the ad server or DSP or DMP analytics suppliers. We do the pitches and we do the contracts directly with the suppliers, and then these suppliers in our tech stack are then used by our partners, by the service partners, by the agencies. So this is also, of course, part of the mission towards data ownership, data access, data security and safety, and of course using first party data on in a way that is very secure and within the firewalls, for example.
Interesting. Amazing. I feel like this conversation could go on for quite some time because it's just delightful to have such a detailed discussion about how you're organising yourself internally to cope with some of those challenges. But we've run out of time, so we'll have to leave that for an ATS event coming to you somewhere near you soon. So thank you very much, Gerhard.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel.
It's been great to have you in the studio this morning. Thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you.
And that was the Mad Tech Podcast.